So, Richard, what the fuck does Star Trek have against Irish people?
I don't know. I mean, it's I think it feels that because it had Miles O'Brien that it's okay to – like this – it's a kind of franchise that says – I have one Irish friend, so I'm allowed to make fun of Irish people. I have this kind of the right, you know? Like, I have the gay friend, so I can make gay jokes or whatever. I think that's Star Trek's view on it.
I would agree with that, but I also think it is extraordinarily strange. And, I mean, Irish stuff and sort of making fun of the Irish has always been a part of American culture. This is nothing revelatory to our listeners. I'm sure that they're all very versed in American history. You know, Irish people were very discriminated against in the 19th century when they first started coming here in large numbers. And that has always been part of American culture. I just don't like Fairhaven is actually like an okay episode. It's a little.
It's
a little unsatisfying for various reasons. It's not the best episode of Star Trek I've ever seen, but it's fine. But it just feels like there is an amusement park style approach to the Irishness of it that I find very odd.
I mean, it's not that different from the Marseille pub in the first season in a way. Like it is a pastiche and obviously this was an alien simulation of it, but World War II in that Hirosian episode, it is a pastiche of the most popular aspects of a thing. So yeah, theme park is part of it. I think the program of Fairhaven is intended to be a theme park in a way. It's explicitly intended in this episode to be a place where everybody can just kind of relax and not have to deal with any reality for a while. And so I don't know. It makes sense that it's this way, but do we find it narratively satisfying to watch that? Do I see the scenes in Fairhaven and think, oh, gee, I would love to step right into there? That would be not necessarily.
No, because there's really a Disneyland aspect to it to me that doesn't seem like it would be that interesting. One of the things that I always find really interesting at the tension at the heart of these holodeck type episodes is that, and I don't know if this is even something that I have sort of consciously thought about or verbalized before, but it's interesting to me that the holodeck is portrayed ever since its introduction in TNG as this fascinating technology that makes these lifelike things possible, and you can't distinguish it from reality. I mean, that's like an Encounter at Farpoint, you know, one of the very first scenes after the horrible Q introduction that took up like 30 minutes of the episode was if you remember, like Riker and Wesley going into the holodeck with Data, and you know, Riker really like amazed at how realistic this holodeck technology was. And time and time again, what we get in holodeck episodes, of course, is like the Paramount backlot, because that's where they filmed Star Trek, and that's all fine. But it does kind of belie something very weird about these holodeck episodes, where there's a suspension of disbelief here that I can do sometimes, but maybe because I am part Irish myself or come from an Irish background, like I find it just a little bit weird. I don't know. I don't think it's a problem, but I also think that you're right. Like it's not the type of place that seems appealing to me to spend any time in. So watching Tom Paris and Harry Kim and all these Neelix, you know, running around Fairhaven, you know, okay, but there's not much there.
That all said, you know, if somebody did tell me, listen, I got this thing and we're going to it's the kind of thing, if somebody invited me to a VR thing like this, I might go and I might even enjoy myself because of the novelty of it. Because obviously holodeck technology doesn't exist now and VR is bullshit. But I don't know, maybe again, we aren't.
But I mean, like that said, like if VR technology worked and was really this realistic, and someone said, "Hey, I have the new Golden Girls VR program," you would totally go for that.
That is fair.
I that's definitely part of it, I think. Well, you know, leaving that aside, I think that
because
this is a really hard episode to start to talk about because it has all the makings of a very interesting episode, but it never really quite gels. And
I mean, to me, the core of the episode, obviously, is Janeway's relationship with the bartender. And this is kind of the next development in her holophobia, right? Like, she has finally gotten to that point, let's accept, where she sees the doctor as one of their own and all of that. And, you know, yes, it took her way too long, but she's finally accepted and understands the nature of what it is to be the doctor and understands his inner life a bit and kind of gets it. And yet when she's actually in the position of, you know, it's fine that she's accepted the doctor, but she hasn't quite done that for all of the holograms. And now that she's in something that approaches a relationship with another, it's freaking her out. Like, I like that development. I think it is an interesting place for her to go. I guess a lot of it hinges on, do we buy this relationship? Do we buy that this guy is going to have Janeway as a purring cat the entire episode, because she is certainly using her sexy voice in this episode?
I mean I buy the relationship. I think that one of the things I like about Voyager a lot is Kate Mulgrew's performance, and she always, when she kind of like has this opportunity to let loose and have some fun, I really enjoy it, because her kind of fun at this is really infectious. And you know, she I didn't know this, but apparently Kate Mulgrew is or was a very heavy smoker. And now that I know that, there are certain things that she says sometimes with her voice where I'm like, oh, I can hear it. And that, I think, is part of it, where she starts to get a little bit. It's an interesting thing where there's a fine line between the actor and the character.
Yeah.
And Patrick Stewart, of course, I don't know that he imbued much of himself with Picard. I think that Avery Brooks imbued a lot more of himself with Sisko. And I think that Kate Mulgrew imbues a lot of herself in Janeway. And I think that, on the face of it, I buy this relationship. You know, Michael Sullivan. I don't know. I can't do an Irish accent. I'm sorry if we have any Irish listeners. He's an attractive man. He seems like the type of person that Janeway would be drawn to for some reason. And then when, of course, she decides to up the stakes and to change his program to make him as appealing as possible to her, that to me also is a very Janeway thing to do. But you're right. Like, I would want the tension at the heart of the episode to come through a little more clearly than it does. Because right now we have sort of this Irish fantasyland pastiche that is only sort of taken seriously, mixed with a Janeway episode looking at her holophobia. And I don't know, it never really comes together for me.
Yeah, I think I'm with that. I mean, it does, because I'm thinking about in the first season, Janeway had that Jane Eyre kind of romance hollow that she would do. And I don't know. I guess maybe this is the case, now that I am talking about it, of the show doing something subtle with the character, because she had no problem playing in the romance with earlier on. She had no problems understanding that, yes, this is just me in a fantasy thing. It's not causing her any existential angst. And I am also fairly sure it would not be surprising if it turned out that she had tweaked that program to more exactly fit her fantasy. And why not? This is it's escapist entertainment. She should certainly be able to have it be to her parameters. Now she's at a point where she has gone through this journey with the doctor, and she finally understands, like, yeah, okay, I can treat some people, hollow people, as real people. And maybe that is why she has such a crisis over this episode. This is kind of her natural instinct, and after she does it, she recognizes, like, gee, this goes at odds with some stuff I've been learning recently.
Yeah, and I mean, I think part of that goes along with the doctors and her conversation sort of at the midway point of the episode, which we will talk about because I think it's really fascinating. But I guess the question I want to ask you right now, though, is because you brought this up, is Voyager is the Star Trek show that really introduced the idea that holograms are people, that the doctor specifically is a person, that holograms may or may not have rights. And I guess the question I want to ask is, like, does that work? Is that a weird thing to do? Because I don't know that Star Trek is necessarily equipped to grapple with this question satisfactorily. Because it calls into question a lot of what people do with holodecks in the Star Trek universe.
You know, it's funny watching this episode after watching Westworld. Now, I don't think you've seen that show, right?
I've watched the first two episodes, and I was like, okay, I get what kind of show this is.
Yeah, but watching it. And you know, it the show is what it is. But yes, it is much more explicitly grappling with these very deep issues of what is personhood? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be a new species? What is the nature of digital consciousness? And all of these kind of meaty things that you can spin on like a bunch of sophomores about for a while, and that's fun and okay. And yeah, I don't think Star Trek is capable of hitting the particular philosophical depths that this conversation requires, particularly as AI technology does get better, and maybe we don't really have to worry about the personhood of AI in 2018, but in 2058, it's going to be a different story. In 2108, it'll be even a different story. You know, so I think what Star Trek is at least trying to do with this, or at least maybe ought to do with this, going along the lines of the original series, using holograms as a metaphor for racism in a way. It makes sense to view this episode as Janeway's somebody who, you know, has a lot of black friends and coworkers and is fine with that, but then actually finds herself interested in somebody African-American and then is a little weirded out about it and is confronting that fact and didn't realize that, you know, all of those kind of things. I think that is the central metaphor of this episode to me.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly makes sense to me. And I think on an allegorical level, the episode works. And I think that's why Fairhaven is such a weird episode to talk about and why I find it so frustrating, because I think it's a noble failure episode. Like, there are a lot of episodes of Voyager that are just not very good. And Fairhaven actually has a reputation of being one of those episodes. But I think that that's unfair. I think this episode is trying to do something, but it's just not quite able to do it. I don't know, though, because If Voyager was a more deliberative or careful show, I think I can definitely see the show deciding to say, okay, we're going to grapple with personhood. We've grappled with personhood with Data, right? We've grappled with personhood with various alien species of the week. And now we're going to grapple with personhood in the sense of a hologram. Is a hologram a person or not? And the doctor is, and if Voyager had come down on the side of, okay, the doctor is a person and has rights because he is uniquely programmed to be self-aware and, you know, can pass the Turing test or whatever the 24th century Star Trek Federation equivalent of the Turing test is, all of these sorts of things, that would be one thing. But what Voyager is doing, and kind of in this episode what the doctor is doing, is he is saying, and the episode seems to be arguing, that all holograms, no matter how basic their programming, have rights and are people. And certainly an argument can be made for that. I am not taking a position one way or the other. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
it's just, it doesn't seem like they have defined the terms of the argument that they want to have very well.
No, I get what you're saying. Yeah, because that's there is what we would call a minimum line for consciousness. Again, we would look at a mosquito and say a mosquito is not a person, right? Or it's, and I'm using some examples from Doug Hofstadter. if you even can agree that a mosquito is a person, well, then there's a line underneath that. Is a bacteria a person? Is an atom a person? There is a line, an imaginary line, over through which, no, this doesn't have personhood in a way. And I think the question is, do holograms hit that line or not? And I almost feel like there is a sense of erring on the side of caution. Yes, maybe this maybe Michael O'Sullivan isn't 100% conscious, but, you know, something, we're Starfleet, we're Federation. We should give him the benefit of the doubt and treat him with respect. We should. I mean, I kind of like that it goes on the metaphor of, even if someone's virtual, it still behooves us to treat them with respect.
Yeah, and I think that something you said there was really interesting, because talking about just whether or not holograms are people, we should treat them with respect because that's what the Federation does. I mean, I think that's actually kind of a sideways way into a lot of arguments that we have in contemporary society around, say animal rights, for instance, and the kinds of ideas that, okay, well, my dog might not be a person, I don't know, but that doesn't mean that I can't treat my dog well, and that doesn't mean that I can't give him enrichment and give him love and give him attention and take care of him and pay attention to his needs. And yes, he can't communicate those needs to me very well, but
he sort of can, you know, when he needs to go outside.
He sort of can. Right. And you know, when he's hungry. These are difficult questions to answer, but I think that's sort of the baseline, that, okay, let's just treat everything as well as we can. But even in this episode, I think that it's muddied because the show very badly wants the Doctor to have a very strong point of view about holograms. And I think the Doctor does. The Doctor thinks all holograms have individual rights and are worthy of respect and cannot be meddled with. But if that's true, then why isn't the Doctor demanding that they don't use the holodeck? I mean, the answer is that they couldn't have a television show, but there's a fundamental disconnect there once you have a holographic character in the main cast. Like, for example, Ship in a Bottle, right? The sixth season follow-up to Elementary Dear Data, where TNG also dealt with this question, right? Like, Moriarty was a self-aware, self-conscious entity. And the show was dealing with that, but it could also deal with it because Data is an artificial life form and had some ideas about that. And also because there was no other hologram that could question this. Now that the Doctor is there, it's kind of like, why isn't he demanding that they stop doing this sort of thing? And I don't know what the answer to that is.
Well, I think it's within the Doctor's personality to be one of those. See, like, there's a couple of different schools of thought. You'll meet people, in queer circles, some who believe that, we need to be asking the streets for rights. They have the ability to give us rights, and we need to get them from that. Or the other, the other view, which is mine, which is that, no, by value of me being human, I have these rights. You don't have the right to take or give that away. Do what you fucking owe. And I think the Doctor is in the first category. The Doctor has said, what was the one where he was on the ship with the killer hologram, and the Doctor very much,
I don't remember the name of it, but
the Doctor very much seemed to believe that, well, I was not treated this way, and I began to patiently, and I showed my value to the crew, and I began to ask for certain stuff, and they eventually, and that's slowly, and so I think that's, the Doctor feels like the Doctor is never the person who is going to demand that unless it hits a straw, like in what the fuck was that episode recently? Why don't I remember any episode titles? The
episode titles on Voyager are fairly indistinct, so maybe that's why.
The one where he has his captain transformation sequence, that recent one, the one where Janeway did end up finally acknowledging his personhood. It took a lot to get to the Doctor to finally be at the point of, no, this is how it's happening. I'm sick of this. And so I think that's why he's not demanding holo rights for the rest of the thing. He as this episode shows, he's taking the tack of asking nicely and convincing through, you know, argument and debate, and ultimately getting them to realize that they're right.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think that the part of what is interesting about that, of course, is the scene that I mentioned earlier with the Doctor and Janeway, where Janeway is kind of, well, really the Doctor kind of draws it out of her, right? This idea that Janeway changed Michael Sullivan, and that made her very uncomfortable. The Doctor says to Janeway, well, what is the problem? You know, people always try and change the people that they're attracted to or the people that are in relationships with. And I think I think that's a little bit of Voyager begging the question, but because I don't know that the Doctor would necessarily say that, but I also think that Janeway's response to that is very interesting, where she says, yeah, you can try, but you don't generally have direct access to their personality.
I mean, there's a difference between, you know, oh, I'd like his beard to look like that, or I'd like it if he dressed this certain way, which is the kind of thing that, yes, you can influence your partner. You can buy them new clothing. That's fine. That's almost innocuous. Stuff like, let's give him an education. Okay, that's a little weirder. You know, you can certainly encourage somebody to read more, for example, but to have changed some fundamental life experiences. And then the line of, well, delete the wife, I mean, that is certainly crossing a line at that point. Even if the beard was towing the line, she crossed it during that. Actually, I think she began with crossing that.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think that's the moment, really, when she realized at least subconsciously, that was the moment when she was really crossing a line. And then, of course, everything that happened after that was, because there's always this thing, right, that they say that when you're uncomfortable in a situation, you were uncomfortable before you actually hit that breaking point.
Yeah.
But you just weren't able to articulate it. And I think that's really what is happening in this episode as well.
You know, I do think it's funny, though, that nobody spares a thought for the wife in this. I mean, she's just deleted from existence in this. It's not like Janeway made it so, oh, well, you know, she was going to marry one guy or the other, and she married Michael O'Sullivan, have it changed so she married the other guy, and then they're happy. And, you know, she just deletes this woman out of existence, and nobody seems to be bothered by that. Like, that, to me, is the bigger transgression.
Yeah, and I mean, on a personal level with Janeway, I think that's a transgression, because that really does cross a line for her. And I think that, if nothing else, this episode is, like you said at the beginning of this conversation, is really about Janeway's growing realization that she is like a holophobe or whatever. But it also is the case that you're right, like, the Doctor doesn't seem to care. No one seems to care. And that's, I mean, part of that is just the nature of holodeck episodes. I mean, people in Fairhaven are not screaming in terror when Neelix is walking down the street, for instance.
Yeah.
Because that's just part of the program.
Even later on, when they see the program itself degrading, they seem to interpret it as, oh, it's stormy. I mean, we've seen a bunch of examples throughout the franchise of how holodeck characters perceive out-of-character stuff.
Well, it really is about maintaining the reality of the situation. Yeah. This is how my improv training is coming back to me now. So now I'm thinking that holodeck characters would actually be very good at improv comedy, but that's a side issue.
Holodeck characters would be horrible in real life, then. Because, God, have you met improv actors?
I have met improv actors. But I think that when it comes down to it, though, that, to me, is the failing of the episode. That it comes right up to making a point and then just kind of doesn't, it just backs away from it because it doesn't quite know what point it's trying to make. And I guess that's okay. Not every episode needs to be perfect, but it's a little frustrating because this episode could have been very, very, very good. And it just isn't.
This episode does not at all fail in ambition and scope. I think I like all of that. It's just not quite there in the execution. Yeah,
the execution isn't there. I mean, interestingly enough, the person who wrote this episode
was executed.
Was executed, maybe. I don't know. We do live in Trump's America. His name is Robin Berger, and he had written for, who apparently also founded the Red Robin chain, hamburger chain. He had written for TNG way back in the third season, and that was a good episode. I haven't watched it in a few years, but I remember liking it quite a bit. So maybe it's just like an unfamiliarity with the Star Trek stuff. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but...
I mean, the Hunted, that was the one where they had the guy and he exists to be hunted by the other kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
In terms of theme, that's a much less meaty theme episode. And in a way, it's a less ambitious episode, but it's able to hit the execution very well because it, again, maybe he understands the characters better, maybe he gets that part of it better, and maybe he just, again, is able to hit it's a lower fruit to hit.
Yeah, that could be. Well, regardless, I think that Janeway needs to have some work on herself. So maybe when they get back to the Alpha Quadrant, she can go to a doctor that deals in holophobia.
That's all I have to
say. Anything else you want to say about Fairhaven?
All right.
Well, one last thing I want to mention about Fairhaven very briefly is Janeway tells this story when she was growing up in Iowa about these horrible thunderstorms that would happen. And I find this very odd because if you remember all the way back in, I forget what Q episode it was because all the names of the Q episodes kind of run together. With the Q that was a thought she was a person, they made mention of weather satellites and Earth and how like Earth had perfect weather because of these weather satellites. So I find that odd.
I mean, that was a series that thought that people never got headaches anymore. So, I mean, what the fuck?
Yeah, that's true too. That's a good point.
Remember the 15 minutes where they were just like, if we go to a certain warp, it'll destroy the universe. And the next episode, they're like, we are not ready to actually deal with this. So please forget that.
Yeah, TNG was maybe not the best at continuity sometimes. All right, let's move on to Blink of an Eye. But before we do that, I do want to take an opportunity to remind all of you listening to this, new listeners, old listeners, middle-aged listeners, that we have a Patreon. What is Patreon, you ask? It is a way for you to support this podcast monetarily by giving us a little bit of your money each and every month. Please go to patreon.com/truckaboutshow and give now.
So... we've been talking a bit about fanfic here and there and on our other now finished podcast, Tuning In from the X-Files. And I have to wonder, watching this episode, how many fanfictions have been written about the Doctor's adventures on the planet?
That is, I will just put my cards on the table. I love this episode.
Oh my God, I loved it too, yeah.
It's so good. But I also find that to be the most disturbing part of the episode.
Well,
because here is a man who was on this planet for a couple of years who had a girlfriend, possibly wife, and a son.
Yeah.
And just they were dead and never saw them again.
And
And
from their point of view, what they meet a guy, they know him for 3 years. He's friends with his landlord. What exactly the nature of their relationship is, but they were close. He had friends. He apparently went to the opera and stuff. He had a life. And then one day he vanishes. And then, I mean, can you imagine them just, and maybe they hire a detective to figure out what the fuck happened. And then they find there are no records of this guy's birth.
Yeah.
Nothing. Yeah. He's never left any fingerprints behind. Like, oh my God, imagine that.
Now I am imagining a true crime style fanfic that is all about this mystery. Because this is like a lot of true crime, right? Like somebody disappears. They never find the body. They never find anything about them. Yeah, it's you know, I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on it. I just think it's important to put out there that is effed up and disturbing.
But I liked the way that I think goes into the strength of the episode, which is that, I mean, this is a 1,000-year time span that happens, and we see little glimpses here and there, but we're able to put together a fairly coherent portrait of what the society might be like. And obviously, everyone's is going to be a little bit different, but I like that. It is a very strong characterization. In a lot of ways, this episode feels like an iteration of The Inner Light except instead of seeing one person's view inside the society, we are seeing the entire society's lifetime through science fiction means.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really, I mean, I had not made that connection between this episode and The Inner Light, and I think that's a good one. I mean, The Inner Light is a much better episode than this, of course, because it has a lot more emotional resonance. But what I like about this episode is that it's a high concept science fiction episode, which is something, you know, Star Trek doesn't do that often. I mean, it does it sometimes, but not all the time. And obviously, like, personally, it really locks into some interests of mine. I really like history, for instance, and that sort of thing. But I just think it's really moving in the ways in which the Voyager crew feels very responsible for what is happening and yet is powerless to stop it. And the ways in which their attempts to mitigate the damage that they are doing to this planet are really not successful in any way, shape, or form. And really kind of, I guess, the failures of the Federation and Starfleet's attempts at mitigating the damage caused by this. Because here we have a situation, right, which the Prime Directive would never have foreseen.
Yeah.
Where there is a planet that is out of sync with the rest of the galaxy in terms of space-time that, you know, I don't know exactly what the calculation is, but like a day... on Voyager, like 100 years go by on the planet or something like that.
It's something I think every second is a day or something. It doesn't necessarily matter over the three, four-day period or even 1-2-day period. They go through 1,000 years, so that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's like over the 5 or 6 days or the week of this episode, you know, 1,000 years have gone by on the planet. That this is really nothing that the Prime Directive has ever been, you know, has ever really seen before. I mean, there's no way to really mitigate the damage that is happening. And, you know, Voyager is only there for what they say is like, you know, 5, 6, 7 days of Voyager's time. But they have really obviously been enmeshed into the culture, the religion, the society of this planet. I mean, that is the first thing that we see from this society. We open up on this sort of like... I don't even know what it is. It's sort of like a Bronze Age-ish sort of thing.
It's like post-caveman, early agriculture days. Yeah, people are still tribal, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And they're talking about the different gods that are represented by the stars in the sky. And then Voyager comes in and it is incorporated into their religion. And then we go back to a sort of Renaissance time period. And now they're talking about how that is not true and all this kind of thing. But the episode I find is very, very smart in detail about interesting ways in which Voyager is incorporated into this planet's culture.
Yeah, I like that the culture is seen as generally benevolent, even if obviously because of the people that we're picking to see, but in general, they're open to understanding and they're curious and scared and weirded out and all of that. But all of the what Voyager represents does shift and change over the course, and yet it's always significant. At first it's a god, then it might just be, then they recognize it's a ship and they don't know who's on the ship, and they have the Skyship Friends dolls that they keep talking about.
Like they're incorporated into children's prayers, are incorporated into children's books, they're, you know, I mean, it's a fascinating thing. And I also there's so many little details in the episode that I think one of the things that I really appreciate about it is that it never really tries to It's a rare episode of Voyager that is very effective in building an alien society or building an alien culture by showing us and not telling us. You know, they don't outright say you can always see Voyager even in the daytime. You know, they say like that little children's prayer that the astronaut recites to Janeway at the end of the episode, you know, indicates that Voyager is always there. It's so bright you can see it in the daytime, you can see it at the nighttime. You know, what would that... How would that affect a planet? Yeah. How would that affect them? And I mean, you could make an argument, for instance, that they would forget about Voyager pretty quickly, but at the same time, probably not. I mean, that's part of the thing of the episode is that there's a strong implication that part of the reason why the society developed so quickly is because of Voyager's arrival.
Yeah, the Daniel Day-Kim character explicitly says, because we're all fascinated by this, we've spent all the scientific progress, and he even worries that without it, is there going to be no carrot to spur us on? And Janeway does mull over the possibility that, well, maybe they'll be trying to find out where it went, and maybe they'll be looking to follow and all of that. And yes, maybe it will, but it is true that they don't know how this is going to change their society. This is something that has been for, again, over 1,000 years.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think that that's really fascinating, though, because that really speaks to a lot of what is really good about Star Trek, where this episode is so surprisingly moving in places. You know, that scene in particular, because Janeway says exactly the right thing in that moment. You know, she tells him what you just said. You know, maybe they'll come and they'll want to find Voyager. And
because I get the sense that this is a society whose people are curious no matter what. And if it's not Voyager, they're still going to be studying the stars. They're still going to be – I mean, we did – the world that we know didn't have any mysterious spaceships in the sky, and yet we are still fascinated enough to go to the stars. So I feel like these people would. Maybe it would have developed at a slightly different time. Yes, and that is the implications from the Prime Directive, but – I personally don't think they're going to stop, particularly knowing that the episode ends with even another goal mentioned, like, look, we know we have this difference in time. We've developed these things that let us go for a few minutes. That's figuring out how to do it indefinitely is the next big scientific goal for the planet. They will always have that goal.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there's something really nice about the implication here that, part of the reason why the society develops in the way it does at the end of the episode. I mean, aside from the brief firing at Voyager towards the end of the episode when some, Trump takes control of the government or whatever the hell happens, is an aberration. You know, that's not who these people are.
Yeah.
We see this society over the centuries as a very rational society, a very friendly society, frankly. And I think that if a society is going to be influenced by anybody, I mean, it's interesting that it's a Federation starship. Now, because really what it comes down to is that, like, yes, Voyager is there and they are influencing this planet and they are also causing these earthquakes, but they don't know anything about Voyager. They don't know anything about the Federation.
Yeah.
They don't know anything about Starfleet. This could be a Kazon ship. This could be a Romulan ship. This could be a Klingon ship. It could be whatever. And it's not going to matter because their development as a society, even though Voyager has affected it, is still being driven by them.
Yeah. I mean, we're told that, I mean, don't they say, their use of iron is so much higher than in any other planet, and that's explicitly said, well, they need to deal with all of these earthquakes, and so we architecture and engineering are going to be wildly different as a result of just the natural phenomenon of Voyager.
And I also like the ways in which the episode, one of the things that I really appreciated is that it very smartly kind of indicates what time period they're in, and they're very true to the ways in which people would interpret this information. I mean, we start out with the sort of like proto-Bronze Age cavemen people that are interpreting Voyager's arrival as a rival god who has come to put the smackdown on one of their other gods. And then we go forward to the Renaissance period, and the protector of this town or whatever is interpreting Voyager as another city, and there are many cities in the sky.
Yeah.
And it's an interest. I love that. I love that vignette for the planet so much because it really does indicate the ways in which their mind works and how I mean, frankly, human society interpreted a lot of these events. And it works because,
well, I really like the character of the protector because he has there are moments where he's just like, well, I demand that they do this and they have to do the end. You know, at first you think, oh God, this guy's going to be an asshole. Like, he's really, pompous and he's going to be a, and his older teacher's like, oh, are you sure you should say order and that? And he softens them. And I like that he's willing to listen to the wiser guy who knows that, you know, let's not go with all guns blazing. Let's do the diplomatic thing. And the protector recognizing that, yeah, no, that's the right thing to do. I should pull back a little bit. Let's be a little more humble on this. I mean, that.
Yeah.
We always talk about how the Federation acts in good faith. These people are acting in good faith. It takes them. Jin from Lost needs to convince them that, yes, I'm the same guy who disappeared 50 years ago, but he is able to, and he is able to effect an actual rescue mission within his lifetime. So, yeah, I mean, we can assume that this did have a sea change very quickly, that he was able to explain what the ship was and what the end, let's try to figure it out.
Yeah, because, you know, we don't know, of course, what the planet would be like if Voyager had not gotten caught in their atmosphere or whatever. But I do think that, I think personally about how frustrating it would be to work in an observatory and very obviously see a spaceship in the sky and be sending them messages over and over again and just not getting any answer back.
Yeah.
And kind of just one of the things that the episode does so well is establish a sense of scale in terms of the time frame that's involved and chooses the vignettes that they show us very well. I think that it's also a really smart choice, frankly, to actually show us these vignettes on the planet. I mean, this could have been an episode that was entirely taking place from the point of view of Voyager, and I don't think it would have been as good.
Yeah, no, we need to see that, the different views that the people have of this ship. I mean, the religious implications of the episode are also fairly obvious. A desire to contact God and the frustration of not having that answer and wondering why. And again, you can figure we see these moments in these people's lives, and by the time we see it on Voyager, two lines in, they've been dead for 50 years. But we can imagine, extrapolate, what did the Protector do when he never received an answer? Did he spend the rest of his life trying to make other messages to the gods? Did he become an atheist after this? Did he decide that this did he get offended? What about the scientist who sends out the message that Voyager actually does hear? Did that shake his faith in the scientific? What about his assistants? What are his doubts? And I like that, again, this is an episode that seems to almost invite fanfic, because we get only these glimpses, and it is unresolved because of the nature of the time, whatever.
Yeah, because I think that one of the things that really works so well about the episode is that there's a lot of things that work really well about it, as obviously we've said a lot, but it does a very good job at sort of, those vignettes are very personal, obviously, and they have very, you know, the characters are not the most interesting characters,
yeah,
but they do have pretty developed personalities for the 4 or 5 minutes that they're on screen. I mean, we only see the actual planet, I think, three times?
It's very archetypal, I would say, which is where it gets its strength, but...
Yeah, it's very archetypal. That's a very good way to put it, and which I think works very well for the episode. But we never go back to the characters. So you get this really nice sense of melancholy throughout the episode, but you also get a very nice sense of time passing and a very nice sense of how societies and cultures progress, right? Like, yeah, that scientist was probably not happy that he never received an answer.
Yeah.
That protector was probably devastated that he never received an answer. But we see what has come after that, and we see the building blocks, and we see how those attempts and those various things have been happening through the years are building on each other. And it's fascinating from a historical perspective.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the other thing too, that we haven't really talked about Voyager at all in this episode, and this is really an episode that is more broad than just talking about Voyager or the crew. But one of the things that I think is really nice about this episode is that it gives Chakotay something to do. And that sounds kind of catty, but he hasn't had a lot to do, and his little anthropology interest comes back, and he gets a chance to have a couple scenes with Seven of Nine and talk about the alien species and talk about how they're developing. And it's nice to see Robert Beltran get some good material and do something really good with it.
Yeah. At the same time, I almost find Voyager an afterthought in this episode. I mean, it could be any ship in orbit.
Yeah, it's totally not the point of the episode.
Yeah. This is, again, I always talk about the, you know, well, this was another ship that, script that they slapped Voyager characters into, and I know that pisses you off, which is why I keep doing it. But, I mean, in
that doesn't piss me off.
No, in some way, like, this could be, you could put the Enterprise crew on here, or you could put the DS9 crew, or really any group of would have the same adventure in it, maybe in the same way, because it is about the society. Again, it has a similar scope to Inner Light, a similar ambition, a similar elegy for the society, as well as celebration of. Obviously, going towards, there is not as much of a sense of loss and tragedy in this episode. It's a feeling of completeness and optimism at the end of this episode. But this is a much more
well, because all of the heartache and all of the devastation and all of the melancholy is leading somewhere, and I think that's. That's really the core strength of Blink of an Eye, which is, it's like the Inner Light, right? Like, all of that heartache and all of that melancholy and all of that stuff that Picard experienced was a society's last gasp attempt to not be forgotten. And Blink of an Eye is almost the exact opposite of that. That, yes, there are these horrible earthquakes that have been happening for 1,000 years because of Voyager, but this has spurred them on to great heights. And they might be at a place at the end of the episode that they may never have gotten to, or it may have taken them a lot longer to get there.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if they had a space program and these aliens get above the atmosphere and they die. They're not going to know why, right? They're not going to have any idea about what's going on. And so It's things like that which make this, I think, actually a more hopeful episode than anything else.
Oh yeah, no, there is the, and again the final scene with him seeing the ship finally wink out of existence, and you know, him crying is a sense of, again, there is a sense of definite change. This is a massive sea change. This may be even the most important historical moment in this society. But it's not going to lead to the apocalypse. It's not going to lead to devastation. This is, frankly, this is the societal equivalent of, now we have to move out of mom's house and go off onto the real world and go off on our own. We are, it's a milestone. It's a coming of age for the society. And nurtured inadvertently and from a distance by Voyager, and then directly at the end, but you get the sense this planet is going to be A-okay at the end.
Yeah, you certainly do get a sense the planet is going to be okay at the end. And you also get a sense that you know, for as important as it has been for this planet and this society, I mean, this is just another day in the life of the Voyager crew, right? I mean, that's the other part of it that I think is so fascinating, because we haven't really talked about the Prime Directive implications of this episode. But, you know, I know you're a sucker for a good Prime Directive episode, and I don't know that I would necessarily call this a Prime Directive episode, but it does have elements of that, probably most clearly the conference room scene where they're debating the merits of whether or not to contact the alien species. And, you know, you get all the different characters giving the different sides of Prime Directive arguments. But at the end of the day, I think this episode is kind of, it's not necessarily what I think what I like about it is that Prime Directive episodes so often are sort of like set up as conflicts. And this one isn't. It's sort of like, yeah, this happened. What do we do about it?
Yeah.
As opposed to a Prime Directive episode, which a lot of times is, should we do this?
Yeah, if they had known, oh, well, we'll get stuck in there, and they'll if any of them had known, they would stay clear of this planet. For all they knew, it was completely uninhabited, because especially, I think when they first scanned it, the life signs were too weak or weren't there yet or hadn't maybe even developed. And fuck, this has happened. What do we... Will any decision we make get us in deeper and be more of a change to the society? Is staying or is staying in and doing nothing, is that going to cause it? As I think it's Tom who points out, like, they know we're here. They've tried to contact us. It's not like we're hiding behind one of those camouflage blinds. They know we're here. They're waiting for an answer. We could easily say we're a ship that's stuck. We need help, and kind of a thing. In a way, the question kind of resolves itself because the planet does eventually become warp capable. By the end, when they are talking to Jin, and towards the end, they've already become a warp-capable society. This is a time where first contact is acceptable. So the question solves itself in a way just by waiting.
Yeah, it does. And I think, like, I don't know, there's almost like a willful disregard for the reality of the situation on the part of Janeway, because, you know, aside from Tom Paris, I think that probably the strongest moment for me in that scene is Chakotay giving an argument, basically saying, look, whether or not we meant to, we have already ingratiated ourselves into their mythos, into their society, into their culture, their religion. And they don't know anything about us, but that is still the case. Don't we have a responsibility to them?
Yeah.
That's an interesting argument. I think I don't know that the episode comes to any answers about that, but that's kind of what the best Star Trek episodes do. They raise the question and have an impassioned debate about it. And at the end of the episode, you're like, okay, well, I could see both sides.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's where I find some of the episode's religious overtones to go. This is their God. Is it more responsible to make a divine intervention and explain what's going on, or just to stay and let them figure it out on their own?
Yeah, because I mean, like, you know, you talk about the inner light. I mean, I also think that this episode has shades of Who Watches the Watchers, which is probably like the, you know, second or third greatest episode. Second or third, like, I don't want to say second or third greatest. It's more like the second or third great episode of TNG, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you've got Measure of a Man, and you've got, like, you know, that kind of that progression where you're like, oh, this show is really swinging for the fences now. And that's kind of, I think, what they're doing here, which is kind of taking the opposite tack of Who Watches the Watchers, which is, okay, this has happened. We may not be able to fix this. We can't go back to a time when this society didn't know that we existed. So what do we do about this? And that this episode is kind of Who Watches the Watchers on a global scale. All right. I think we'll call it an episode. If you have any thoughts on either the episodes of Star Trek Voyager we just talked about, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com.
It is the best way to get new listeners to listen to our podcast.
As I said earlier, patreon.com/trekaboutshow is where you can go if you would like to financially support Trek About by giving us a monthly gift. We very much appreciate any amount that you can give, preferably $100,000 a month, but we'll take a dollar a month if you got it. patreon.com/trekaboutshow. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, we are there. Trek About Show is our username in all those places. And as always, please leave us an Apple Podcast review for Trek About. It has been a while since we've received one, and we are feeling sad. So make us feel better by leaving us a review. All right. Next week, we're going to cross the halfway mark of the sixth season of Star Trek Voyager. We are rapidly coming to the end, Richard. Are you prepared? Are you ready?
No.
All right. Next week, we're going to be talking about Virtuoso and Memorial.